This is Martin Willis, your host. My guest tonight is Gary Heseltine. He has a great background in law enforcement and UFOs both. Perfect guest for the show. I do want to tell everyone we have a great blog over at podcastufo.com, and that is about police officers who became UFO investigators. It's a great blog by Charles Lear. Go check that out. Last week, I spoke about Leslie Kane. She might have more to uncover. Well, I guess I was a little presumptuous in that. Nothing more is coming out now. I did want to clarify that, but she will be a guest on the show on March 31st. And I do want to thank everyone over at YouTube, because last week my friend and guest, Chris O'Brien, fell asleep before the show. So he slept through our show. I was going to cancel, and I had plenty of work to do. But you, the listeners, you stepped up, and we made a show out of it. And it became quite the thing, actually. I got a number of email of people that really enjoyed it, and people are saying, you got to have another one of these. Well, how about if I have a more of a professional one? I mean, I call it ahead of time instead of off the cuff. And on St. Patrick's Day, just don't drink the green beer. We will have a call-in show on the 17th of March. That's a Tuesday. So I will announce that ahead of time so you can get your questions or UFO stories, whatever it is you want to talk about, and get all that ready. And so let's see. Contact in the Desert. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to be there. So hopefully I will meet up with some of you listeners. That would be great. I know a lot of people attend that. That's at the end of May. And next week, we have Chris Rutkowski on from Canada, Rutkowski. And the week after, we have Chuck Zukowski. And I don't know how I'm going to get through that without messing that up. But anyway, those two are coming up. So without further ado, well, first of all, I do want to thank everyone that helps out with the show and supports the show. It's very important, and it's how we stay on the air, and I do appreciate it. Gary, welcome to the show, or I should say welcome back.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Now, Gary, before we get into the law enforcement part of what you are doing, let's have a little bit of your background. You had did you have a childhood sighting or an early sighting in your life?
Yeah, I had a childhood sighting that kicked off my interest when I was 16 in my hometown of Scunthorpe in Lincolnshire. Basically, cutting a long story short, I was walking my then girlfriend home. I was pushing my bicycle. We were walking along a long, narrow footpath. It was a lovely August summer night. All the stars were out, which is pretty rare in the UK. No wind. It was summer, August, and it was a really nice, warm evening. And suddenly, we saw a bright white light, no distinct shape, but bigger than the background stars, moving right to left. And what was interesting is, as the object passed in front of us, all the electricity in the housing at the end of the footpath went off, as if like everything behind its flight path was in a power cut, a power grid failure. We watched it again for a few more seconds, no noise, probably at a 60-degree elevation, and then there was another power cut or a power grid failure behind it. I had my bicycle with me at the time, so I said, get on the bike, on the crossbar, and I rode very quickly to the end of the alleyway, turned right and went about 250 metres, dropped her off at her house. I then rode as fast as I could go along the same alleyway, footpath, in the hope of trying to catch up this light that was moving very slowly in the direction of where I lived, my home. If you can imagine an entire area plunged into darkness, no electricity anywhere, it's dark, and everything is black effectively. I'm riding as fast as I can go, and yet very close to my home, there was a left-hand bend in the road, and at that point, I could see that the power was on beyond the bend. So as I reached the bend, I looked over to my right shoulder and realized that I'd managed to get just ahead of the strange light that I'd seen. I went round two corners, Westdale Road, Baysdale Road, where I lived, stopped at number three, dropped my bike outside, rushed inside to my parents. They were having traditional cup of tea, supper, as we call it in the UK, probably about 9 o'clock. And I said, come outside. I think there's a strange light. I think there may be a power cut. And they just looked at me bemused, didn't move, which isn't surprising. I ran through the hall, ran through the kitchen, out through the back door into my garden, went to the bottom of my garden, turned around to look at my semi-detached house. And just as I did so, the light was coming over my rooftop, although it was much higher in altitude now. And I don't know why, and this is always very puzzling when these things happen, I did something instinctive. I put my hand up as if I was answering a question in class, straight up, like to form a 90 degrees. And as soon as the object went past my hand, entire area plunged into darkness. Wow. Now, that's impossible to predict. So I realized that at that time, that object, whatever it was, must have had some interaction with the power grid because I'd moved to a second geographical position. It was impossible for me to predict the power cut. And so that's what kicked off my interest.
I guess so. That was quite a sighting. There's been a lot of cases. If you would, can you turn your audio down just a little bit? We're having some feedback. There has been a lot of cases where automobiles, did you happen to see any cars running that stalled out? Because there's a lot of cases like that.
No, I actually, funnily enough, when I thought about this many years later, I don't remember seeing any cars on the road, which is strange because it was quite a busy road. It was called Grange Lane South. And I don't recall seeing a car, but I was probably so fixed on trying to get back, I may not have noticed, but I don't recall seeing any car. But what was really strange is the fact that on that corner, the power was on. So you had this surreal experience of going from pitch darkness into electricity and the light. It was that. There was a demarcation of a street lamp. So before it was complete darkness, and then beyond it, all the power was on in the homes and the windows. So it was a very kind of surreal experience. But that's what kicked off my interest. I had none prior to.
Have you ever wondered what the mechanics were that would have turned these, the lights off in particular homes, like electromagnetic issues or something like that? Have you ever tried to figure what that could have been?
Well, I guess it would be some kind of EM interference. But the thing is, I didn't know anything about the subject. And then when Close Encounters came out after my sighting, if you think about the early part of the film, Richard Dreyfuss goes up on top of a hill and he sees the UFOs, and there's like a power grid going off block by block.
Right.
And it was kind of like that, but not from an aerial perspective. So that came after my sighting. And I remember the first thing that I did, because we're talking 1976, a long time ago, I was 16. And so basically it was just before the video cassette era, and where you could control and get videos, VHS, Betamax, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
The only thing that I could do to find anything about flying saucers, I'd heard the term, obviously, UFOs, I'd heard the term, was go to my second-hand bookshop in the suburb of where I lived, which was called Ashby. And I remember going in the second-hand bookshop. And this is really strange. The first book that I got was by Major Donald Kehoe, who turns out to be a major hero, perhaps the greatest UFO hero from an ET perspective of drumming, kept saying, it's ET, it's ET. And I find that of all the books that I could have found, I found his last book, Aliens from Space. And it was remarkable because in that, there was an entry about the New York blackout, I think 1965, and the eastern seaboard was knocked out for about 7 or 8 hours.
Right.
And millions of people were trapped in lifts, everything stopped kind of thing. And that was rumored to have been triggered by UFOs overloading the power boxes. So straight away I got some kind of confirmation that this was not unheard of, what I'd seen.
Amazing. Yeah, there was quite a baby boom right after that blackout.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
So just to let the listener know, we have Lee Spiegel is going to be coming on after the top of the hour, just for a quick a minute here. He's got an announcement to make. So I think I see – do I see cats in the background in your house? Oh, no, that's a dog. It's just a long way away.
No, that's the stuffy. That's the stuffy.
The dogs wouldn't get along good with cats probably.
No, they probably wouldn't, because if they see a cat on the TV, they go mad. So,
so let's talk about your background in police and law enforcement. When did you get involved in that?
Well, I began by becoming a military police officer. I served in the Royal Air Force Police for 6 years, between 1983 and 1989, and. I always think that this is relevant as my story has progressed, is that of my 6 years, about three of them were served doing guarding nuclear weapons on tactical nuclear weapons on two nuclear weapons storage areas. Now, if you think about that, my subsequent research and involvement in the Reynolds and Forrest case, I have a kind of a unique background because I did exactly the same as what the U.S. Air Force Security Police did in the 81st, I was on the weapon storage areas, I guarded the nukes, I walked the wire, I rode around on mobile, I did everything that the 81st did, who were involved in the Rendlesham event. So I kind of had a unique insight into that, and I'd always realized, just because of the numbers involved, that there must have been many more witnesses, especially when people were rumoured to have seen beams being shone down into the nuclear weapon storage area. Now, I know from the RAF's point of view that they were always roving two-man patrols, walking around. There were other single-person patrols along designated lines of fences. So I knew that there would be witnesses to that. And now, obviously, my research into Capel Green has uncovered a witness, Steve Longero, who is was one of the 81st, who was inside the weapon storage area that he confirmed was deployed with tactical nuclear weapons, and that he was inside when he saw UFO shine a beam down into the nuclear storage bunkers. So that's a pretty big deal, and that will be covered heavily in Capel Green. Confirmation.
Pardon me. Before we move on from that, I just wanted to say that you know, I've had I had Charles Hult on a few times. But one time I had him on, I asked him, you know, were there nuclear warheads? And he upset that I asked that question and said it's classified. I can't answer that. So how would this this person that you spoke with, how can he freely talk about it? I mean, is it not classified?
Because he was never an officer, he was a young airman. He was only newly arrived on base. He was the lowest of the low in terms of rank. He was put with a senior airman on the weapon storage area. He'd only been passed out to go on shift a few days. Wrong time, wrong place. But he's there walking around with his M16 when he sees a UFO and it shining a beam down into the weapon storage area. Don't forget, I had a 7-year collaboration period with Charles Hult, developing a film script that I'd written, and he collaborated with me on that until I ended it in late 2014. Basically, I have a good insight into Charles Hult. And Charles Hult, as an officer, and a senior officer at that, mm-hmm. he's always took the stance I can neither confirm or deny. But I never understood why the likes of John and Jim say the same thing, because I can tell you that six witnesses in Capel Green will say it's tactical nuclear weapons that were guarded, and they weren't officers.
Wow. And in your opinion, do you think that whole event had to do with the weapons? I mean, is that a possibility?
I think it's the key. Again, we digress slightly, but the first night I sat down and talked with Colonel Hult was during the filming of a UFO Hunters episode in the UK when he had been flown over with Bill Burns and his crew. And I was there because of my background in the RAF police with nuclear weapons. And I'd suggested I go along because I'd like to ask Colonel Holt some questions. Well, I knew that he was never going to say it publicly that there were nuclear weapons there, and I understand that. But privately, we on the first night we arrived, he didn't know me, but I knew of him. We met up at the hotel. We were told we weren't needed that night. This was kind of 6, 7 p.m. So we ended up chatting in a bar next to the hotel, I think it was, or the hotel bar, for 3 or 4 hours. And we got on famously. And he told me there and then that there were more nuclear weapons there than anywhere else in Europe. Now, wow. What you've got to understand is that nuclear weapons, it was a nuclear weapons base. The weapons storage area is for nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons to be deployed on aircraft to go at a moment's notice to fight the Soviet regime as it was. Now, he said that again to me 3 years later when he was doing some filming. Well, when we were doing a walk round, my wife was filming on her iPhone as we did a walk round of the forest, again, as it was for another documentary that never actually was aired. But we had some free time and it was daytime, and I said, well, why don't we do a walk round? So we did a walk round, basically trying to see if it would trigger any memories, and it did, and we had a very good conversation. Now, at various points, and I want to point out that my wife is not a camera woman at all. In fact, she's not very good, to be honest, but she took intermittent film clips with his knowledge and as we were walking around, and actually there was probably 30 minutes of footage altogether. And whilst he didn't say it on camera, he said it to both of us in the presence and hearing of Lynn, who was only a few metres away, that there were more nuclear weapons than anywhere else in Europe. Now, I'd kind of forgotten all about that, but after his book came out, The Whole Perspective, he kind of denied saying that to me, and yet he'd said it to me twice. Well, the second time, he'd said it in front of my wife, and I'd forgotten all about that, but she said, no, I remember that. And I said, why do you remember that? And she said, because he was talking about the peace protesters at RAF Greenham Common, which was a US air base where tactical nuclear weapons were supposed to have been stored. That's where the peace protesters thought they were. And she said, I had a friend who was part of that peace protesters, and he was very dismissive of them, and it kind of triggered, and I felt indignant towards him because he was having a put down, effectively one of my friends. So that's her trigger memory, which is a very good trigger memory. I'm just going to let the dogs out.
Yeah.
There you go. Carry on. So that was a trigger memory for her. And so, she's happy to corroborate me on that. So I really do think that Rendlesham Forest is all about nuclear weapons, because you've got to set it in the time frame. In December of 1980, there were two major world crises going on. The Iranian hostage crisis, which is obviously the Middle East, and that was a powder keg. And obviously the US people were very upset about that. But more importantly, in many ways, was what was going on in Europe, because this pertained to the British bases, because they would be at the forward end of any Soviet expansion into Europe. And so basically what you had was hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops massing on the Polish border. Now, a bit of a history lesson there, the Soviet Union had put down revolts in Hungary and Czechoslovakia by rolling the tanks in and quelling public revolution. And there was every chance that the Polish shipyard workers, it was going to happen again. So there were hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops massing on the borders. So you've got two major world crises going on. And think about what I was told. More nuclear weapons there than anywhere else in Europe. They shouldn't have been there in the numbers. That's what I think it's all about.
You know, Charles and I had a disagreement of something that he told me in North Carolina back in 2013. And I brought it up on the show, and it caused a problem. It caused a major problem. And unfortunately, I lost a friend. I had a friend all because of this issue. And Charles and I straightened it out basically that to the fact that he's saying that I think that I heard him say it, and he thinks that he did not say it.
Put it this way, I know who I'd put my money on, and it would be you.
Well, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, it just didn't pan out too well.
To understand, we digress slightly, but what you've got to understand is that I've now been looking into Rendlesham publicly since that very first UFO Hunters program in a public way as a researcher from late 2007. And here we are almost 13 years later. So I have a big knowledge, and obviously I've done a lot of investigation over the last 2.5 years, both with witnesses and going over whatever material has been out there in the past and previous research. And I would have to say that Colonel Holt, as many other people have kind of come to the conclusion, has been one of the most disinformation people out there about Rendlesham. And yet I had no idea when I started my collaboration that that would be the case. Why would I doubt the word of a colonel? However, as time went on, I realized that he knew a lot more. He'd said that he would always tell me everything, but clearly as time went on, he knew a lot more that he'd never told me. And subsequently, after I ended the relationship, I've found out a lot of things, and from other witnesses where they're in broad disagreement with him, but not the John, Jim and Charles Holt show, I'm afraid. There is real discord when you talk to other witnesses who were there, who don't come forward because they don't like the narrative, the way it has been portrayed for almost 25 years now since they retired. And I think this will change when Capel Green comes out, because all I'm bothered about is the truth. And the cards fall where they fall, from my point of view. What would be my point in lying? There is no point. Your credibility just goes out the window. Nick Pope seems to think that I should be locked up for perpetrating a hoax on the UFO community. Well, why would I do that, Nick? I have nothing to hide, and you're in for a shock when Capel Green comes out this summer.
Wow.
And it needs to shake things up, because the narrative is being steered and it is wrong. Just as an investigative point of view, think of many people now put Rendlesham, because of its consecutive nights event, as being up there with Roswell. Some people think it's better than the Roswell case. It's hard to ever determine, but it's an important case. But the point being that there is a lot more information that is known, and yet it doesn't ever get aired on TV, in documentaries, and I think there's a reason why. And it has, sadly, to do a lot with Colonel Holt.
Well, I might as well, I have nothing to lose at this point, so I might as well say what was said. And unfortunately, Robert Hastings was a friend of mine, and he will not even return a phone call or email or anything, because I basically said on air, Charles Holt, said to me and one other person, we were standing there in North Carolina, you know, I said, are you talking, you know, he mentioned that terrible things happened to the people and it happened to me too. And I said, and then he said he never said it. So
does the other person that was with you corroborate what you heard?
I have no idea who it was. It was someone else that was attending the conference. And I can picture what he looks like, but I just don't know. I never knew that.
Well, let me give you an example of Charles Holt's memory. When, for that UFO Hunters program, literally this is the first 2 days I've met him, I suggest that we go up onto the weapon storage area. It was a great thrill for me to get on there. And I said I'd like to go up to the top of the 80-foot weapon storage area tower that gives a full 360, because I'd worked in those towers and so I knew what to expect. And we got up there before the film crew, there at the bottom, setting up their equipment, ready to come up to the top. And I had my video camera with me, my own personal video camera. And I said, would you do a little piece for me, what you'd already told me? And he said, yeah, fine. And basically, on camera, which I've got the clip, and it's been out in the public domain for several years, is he says, and it's almost verbatim, I said, tell me what you just told me. And he said, well, I've been approached by somebody who was in the tower on one of the nights, and they basically said that they too saw the beams come down into the weapon storage area. And then he added, which was totally unprompted, and the men on the ground also saw it too, walking around inside the weapon storage saw it too. Now, again, that's on video. Now, you can't take it back if it's on video. And yet he has denied ever saying what he said to me. And so I leave you with that conundrum on Charles Holt. And I believe in some way that he has been compromised to keep to a certain line by his allegiance to the U.S. Air Force and his rank.
Wow, that's interesting. So anyway, I just wanted to just finish off that, you know, what I had just said. I said it, but still it's he said to me that, again, I'm just going to repeat what I said before, that he told me that he does believe that I thought I heard him say that. And he does believe that he did not say that.
What you're saying is news to me, but it wouldn't surprise me at all, because it really doesn't make sense, as he claims, that he was never interviewed, never questioned. That doesn't make sense when we're talking about consecutive nights of UFO activity. And I can reveal it's on the base too, on the base in several areas over several days. It's not just in the forest. And yet all of that was played down. And in fact, there are some major incidents to come out that will be revealed in Capel Green from military witnesses who were there, who've told us that these things happened, and they bear no correlation whatsoever to many of the things that Colonel Holt has said.
Wow. So do you think that there was a lot more that happened? I mean, was every single person person debriefed that had the sighting, and he claims he was not? Is that what the situation is?
He always told me that he, and he said it on many TV documentaries, that he, having put in the Holt memo, that he never heard back from them, and that he was basically never debriefed officially or anything like that. Personally, I always found that very difficult to believe because of his rank. But subsequently, with everything that I've learnt of him over the many years since I began to get to know him, sadly, I'm distrustful of him, which is quite a big thing to say, because we got on famously. But in the end, he has said too many things, and other people have noticed, other researchers have noticed that he would stir things up from time to time. But having spoken to many witnesses who are still yet to go forward publicly, they kind of say they don't like the way that the Rendlesham case is portrayed, i.e. effectively the John, Jim and Colonel Holt show. And yet, if you think what I was going to say about... my dogs have heard something, so they've gone mad. They'll settle down. Hey! Calm down. And
do you have any milk bones by chance?
No. My wife made a cup of tea and she'll have heard her, so they've gone mad. Hey. Look at that. Power. But yeah, here's a conundrum for you. Think of any world-class case that's been investigated by UFO researchers around the world, and very rare will you find that three of the principal witnesses have become the principal investigators. That is not particularly healthy for an independent investigation, because they have, I suspect, an agenda, each of them in their own different ways. It's not a good, healthy investigation policy to have a direct witness. It's not like, I saw the murderer plunge the knife in and I'm going to become the chief investigator. It doesn't work like that. Researchers come in, investigators come in, and they do the research and uncover whatever it finds. But unfortunately, with the Rendlesham Forest case, and especially in the United States, where it's pretty much a closed shop, in my opinion, from this overseas part of the world, the case has very much been frustrated, I think, by a narrative of Colonel Holt in particular, saying to TV producers, I don't want him on that show. I don't want him on that show. It shouldn't really be like that. It should be independent investigations by TV companies interviewing principal witnesses, not being led by seniority of an experienced officer. I suspect that is because he was a colonel, and people don't like questioning the colonel. The colonel is never questioned about the many different statements that he said over the years, the many different statements he said about the dates on the memorandum, he says they're now a mistake. But are you telling me that 2 weeks after an event that was so awe-inspiring that it happened on several nights, that you would get the dates wrong? Well, that's effectively what Colonel Holt has done, because he said it was the 27th in the memo, and then two nights later, then it was his night, as it were. Well, he has subsequently said, no, it's the 25th into the 26th, and it's all there because of the police record. But I just find it, as a former military police officer, inconceivable that a senior officer could make such a glaring error with the dates. And he has done that and repeated it many years later in several TV documentaries and got the wrong dates, so, or the right dates, depending on what you believe.
Wow. I actually get along well myself with Holt. And, you know, I was sorry that the whole situation happened when it happened. But let me ask you about this. So this, and we got to go to break in about 10 minutes, so we got a good amount of time. But the case of Rendlesham Forest, I've said this a number of times on the show over the last 8 or 9 years, however long I've been doing it. It's very convoluted. There's so many different twists and turns. And then there's Larry Warren, and you actually were you thinking that Larry he's been discredited, but from what I understand, you don't believe he's been discredited.
Who's he being discredited by? By some trolls in the UK who lead an active campaign?
No, I'm talking. Well, think about Peter Robbins, who's worked directly with him for many years.
I got emails from Peter Robbins after his cessation saying that Larry was there in the forest. I've got emails. I've got Facebook messages saying he was there. But he, I believe, was pressured. And I think that when the trolls went to Peter Robbins and said, oh, we've got this massive evidence against Larry Warren, you're going to have to disassociate yourself, I think he jumped ship without actually studying their evidence. And their evidence is a lot, but it's a lot of nothing. And as an investigator, I think I can pick between what is truth and fiction and what is accurately reported and not over the years. And believe me, the evidence falls very firmly on Larry Warren. And again, as just before Christmas, it came out from John Burroughs that Sergeant Adrian Bustinza, who's never gone public in terms of on camera, had told John that he was about to go do a piece for Capel Green. Well, I can reveal that I've done two interviews with Adrian Bustinza, and he reveals a lot, and it is nothing like what people are thinking, and it is very good for Capel Green. That's all I can say.
Well, you know, I don't want to make this show about bashing people.
No,
especially when they can't. When they can't defend themselves. But I will say this, though. There's been a lot of other things that Larry Warren has done that is just, you know, not true. Celebrities' guitars and, you know, all these Photoshopped images and things like that. So I personally, when someone has one part of their personality that is untruthful, I have a hard time believing the rest of it. That's just my own personal, you know.
That's fine. But let me tell you this. Has Larry Warren ever been arrested, interviewed, questioned by the police over selling false memorabilia, merchandising, music memorabilia? And the answer is no. So where is the evidence that took place? And the answer is, there is no evidence. There's a lot of people saying it, but that is not evidence. Evidence comes in the form of arrest, charge, going to court. If somebody is called a fraud, I get the impression that you, if somebody said that you, Martin Willis, is a fraud, I would think, well, that guy's got a conviction for fraud of some kind. And yet, I'm sure you haven't. But people in social media land can say whatever they want. And unfortunately, the social media laws are so weak, they can get away with it. And as I say, this is just part of a campaign. And when you look at the actual evidence, he's never been arrested, charged, or anything. And yet you on this show have just repeated something that is actually without foundation. Because you have no charge to arrest. You have no arrest, interview, police station. There's no evidence. It's stories. But it's come deliberately because they want to discredit this guy. Because what is Rendlesham about? It's not about John and Jim's landed craft on the first night. It's not really about the other nights, which are impressive on themselves. But if we link to nuclear weapons, which we talked about earlier, do you think that if a certain person corroborated Larry Warren in a field and said he was next to Larry Warren in a field surrounded by 10 to 12 airmen and that it was being filmed on motion picture cine film, do you not think that that would be pretty compelling?
Well, yes, it is compelling. Yes, I agree with that. But I will tell you also that, you know, Peter Robbins is a good friend of mine, and I trust the fact that if he feels like he's personally been affected, then and he actually withdrew the book from the market because of it. I mean, he feels that strongly about it.
That's not true either. They both withdrew the book. Peter said he wanted it withdrawn. The Cosimo Books then said, okay, we're going to have an internal investigation. It is temporarily pulled. In that time, Larry Warren said, I want the book pulling too. They then said, yes, the book is pulled. There was no result of any internal investigation. And there are some real questions about Cosimo's behaviour in all of this. But the point is, it was no result of any investigation that said that Larry Warren was at fault for anything. It was suggested they both withdrew it.
Okay, well, you know, for me to argue with a detective... I feel like I'm going to get arrested if I say something wrong, but anyway.
You're entitled to your opinion, like everyone is. But the problem is I used to be friends with Peter Robbins prior to this reinvestigation. But when Peter disassociated himself, I had email exchange with him, and he admitted that Larry was in the forest. He's never really doubted that. He'd been, I think, effectively pressured by these trolls who led a campaign to discredit him. And he thought, I'll jump ship. Unfortunately, he jumped too early, in my opinion. But the point is, since that time, I have a lot of screen grabs involving Peter, dealing with some very nasty online trolls. And he's also got involved in personal abuse towards myself. And sadly, we are no longer friends because of that. I liked Peter, but what do you do when somebody is saying things that are actually untruthful about me?
Well, what would you guess the reason that this whole, if this is like a disinformation or whatever it is, or you're calling these trolls, why would these trolls want to attack and destroy Larry's credibility to begin with? What goal would they have?
That's actually too simplistic. You've got to understand Colonel Holt in all of this. Colonel Holt, the trolls report directly back to Colonel Holt. The lead troll was the person who supplied the information for the Holt perspective. I have that in writing from both Holt and from the lead troll. So that is corroborated both ways. She supplied the information for the Holt perspective. So all of it was based on a crock. Now, you've got to understand Colonel Holt has always had a thing against Larry Warren, right from the off, probably because of Larry's involvement going public And his involvement in speaking to Larry Fawcett in early 83 that led to another request for a Freedom of Information Act that went in by cause that effectively got the memo out. Now, the memo, Larry Warren didn't know there was a memo, but effectively he played a part in getting a memo out that he did not know existed. But that came out after numerous denials by various researchers, both in the UK and the US. And they'd done that. And they denied, and then suddenly it comes out because Larry Warren had told Larry Fawcett, I'm prepared to give my name on the record. So when they went back, that changed the opinion, and they suddenly produced the Holt Memo, which is a very famous document for obvious reasons. But when that happened, Colonel Holt tried his damnedest, and he told me this personally. He told me he did not want the memorandum to come out, because if it came out, his life would never be the same. Well, guess what? It came out, and his life was never the same. And you're telling me that as a colonel in the Air Force who may have looked at one time to becoming a general, that this was good for him? I suspect not. So I think he probably had something of a grudge against Larry right from the off. But right from the off, as soon as Colonel Holt retired, he was saying, Larry Warren was kicked out. He wasn't kicked out. He got a honourable discharge. He was saying he was busted for drugs. He was never busted for drugs. He has done his damnedest to destroy the credibility of Larry Warren. And this has gone on. And don't forget, Larry Warren was in the public eye for the first 8 or 9 years alone in the media. From really 83 onwards, initially as Art Wallace and then in his own name, after the story broke worldwide in October of 83. Initially, he was Art Wallace, and then as time went on, within a couple of months, he is coming out as Larry Warren. Now, from that point on, he is the only person giving his right name, going on camera for the first 8 or 9 years. That all changes as soon as Colonel Holt stops and retires, when John Burroughs retires and Jim Peniston retires. Amazingly, as soon as they retire, they really effectively all gang up on Larry Warren, saying, no, he's affecting the case, he's bringing discredit, and they join effectively with Holt and do him down, as it were. They don't want him on TV programs with them because his account is out there. And yet, what I come back to you and say, what's this all about? Would I put this to you, if the Capel Green scenario, i.e. a landed craft in a field surrounded by security police, there are entities seen, there is senior officers who arrive and have a silent face-off, that it's been filmed on cine camera, motion picture footage, not still cameras, as well as still cameras that are also taking photographs. If that occurred, do you think the US Air Force, do you think the US Department of Defense, do you think the US government, do you think the British government, do you think the British Ministry of Defense would want that to come out as fact? No, they don't want that to come out as fact. So what have they got to do? They have to destroy anyone who's connected to that. But what they forgot is Adrian Bustinza.
All right. Well, we're going to have to go to break now. We're a little late for break. So when we come back, we're going to have Lee Spiegel on the line. And we're also, I want to get back into the Rendlesham Forest topic only because I want to ask you what you think really happened, because there's 9 million legs to this. And I'd like to figure out what your opinion is. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back.
In 3, 2, 1, go.
Alrighty, welcome back, everyone. We have my friend, I can say that right, Lee Spiegel, on the line. Lee, how are you?
I'm fine. Yes, during the commercial, we actually did confirm that we were friends. That's good.
Thank God I was going to hang up on you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Lee, always fun to talk to you, and I really enjoy your show, Edge of Reality. It's on Thursdays on KGRA Radio, and it's on at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I catch as many as I can. Last one I caught was with Mark D'Antonio. That was a lot of fun. And how's that show's going pretty well. I mean, you have a lot of listeners. I know that. And you're having a good time being back on the air, right?
I am, and I love your show as well. I do. It's nice to be able to do these little crossover things. But yes, thank you for your supportive words, and I send them right back to you, you know?
Awesome. Well, Lee, I understand you have some type of announcement to make, and I would like for you, I'm honored that you're actually going to make it on my show instead of waiting until your show on Thursday night, and you're going to do both. But if you could, let's hear it. What's going on?
Are you talking about the fact that I just recently got married? No, it can't be that. Well, as you and many of your listeners probably know, I have been working on a new upcoming UFO documentary with director James Fox, and the name of the program is The Phenomenon, and it is now scheduled, kind of rescheduled, because it's been taking a long time to put this together. It's now scheduled to come out first as a theatrical release this fall, probably in September, but what I'm announcing on your show now first, and I'll do it again on Thursday on my show, is Thursday, I'm going to give out an actual YouTube address where people can go to see the very first and official The Phenomenon trailer.
So it's the trailer.
Yeah.
We're talking about the trailer. All right.
About 2.5 minutes long. It's like a preview of coming attractions, you know. And I've seen it like 3 times now. And it's like razzle dazzle. I think people are going to go, wow, they're going to show what? So, it's very cool. I'm very happy with it. And people will be able to finally see the trailer on Thursday.
Well, excellent. We can't wait. I know I can't wait. And because I love James Fox, the work he does is just amazing.
Yeah.
Out of the Blue, I Know What I Saw. Those are two of my very favorites. Mm-hmm. Someone has just emailed me this, I think it was this morning or yesterday, and said, hey, whatever happened to the metamaterial? So is that going to be addressed in this film?
Oh, yes, indeed. Okay. In fact, we're going to take you and the audience into pretty much a top secret laboratory in Silicon Valley, where some very serious scientific research is ongoing now about metamaterials. James and I were invited to that laboratory last October, and what we saw was amazing. So, yes, it's going to be there.
Wow. Well, that's good. And I know can you talk about the opening of the film, or is that we just have to wait for the trailer?
You know what? I can tell you that what the opening is going to be like is we're going to focus on kind of a very famous close encounter with a UFO that took place in the 1950s during a flight in the South. The commander of this Air Force bomber, was Bill Coleman, who went on to become Lieutenant Colonel Bill Coleman of the Air Force, became the official public spokesperson for Project Blue Book during the days of Project Blue Book. But back in the 1950s, he was a commander of this bomber, and they played a game of tag with what essentially was, as he even describes it, it was basically a flying saucer. And through wonderful wonderful means and photographic ways we're going to show this encounter. And it will, you'll go, whoa, look at that. It's really something to see. It sets the whole tone for the whole documentary.
Yeah, well, we can't wait. So, everyone, yeah. You can catch Lee's show over at KGRA Radio, and that's every Thursday evening at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Lee, great talking to you, as always, and we'll be talking soon.
Thank you, Martin. Good to be on. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
All right. So here we are. We're back. We're back. And, you know, we sort of, I feel, Gary, that we have just a little bit of a, I want to say a little bit of a negative tone going in this show. And it's and it's because of, you know, the as I mentioned earlier, the convoluted story of Rendlesham Forest. And, you know, we're going to get into other topics. But for now, can we, the best way you can you describe what you think really happened there, because of all the stories that don't really line up? And it doesn't have to be a big, long, drawn out thing. Just kind of, you know, in a nutshell type of thing, if possible.
Probably the most difficult case to explain in a nutshell, but I'll try. There is, without a shadow of a doubt, this is UFO related. There were a number of precursor cases that would be looked at in Capel Green in the early part and throughout 1980, leading up to late December. That sets the tone. These were all UFO experiences. They weren't lighthouses or formation rabbit teams. They were UFO experiences that all culminated in the late December consecutive nights. There's been real debate about how many nights that will be covered. There are at least three, probably four. All right. There is multiple evidence of multiple different types of objects being seen on multiple consecutive nights, both in the forest and on the base. This has been played down by the Air Force, but there were several incidents on the bases of Woodbridge and Bentwaters. There are some spectacular things that have yet to emerge, because a lot of people have been reluctant to ever come forward, but they are now beginning to come forward. And sadly, I can't reveal those now, but they're going to come out. And there are... Just to put it as a rough figure, there are about 15 incidents over several days. Different incidents, different objects, different places. Now, this is not probably what you were thinking, maybe two or three incidents. No, this is a lot more. This is a very UFO-related. Why they're there, I think it was to do with nuclear weapons, because at a time of world crisis, there were more nuclear weapons there than there should have been. That probably broke all the armament agreements between the US and Britain, hence why nobody will ever confirm that in authority, because if it did, it would be straight on the front page of every 6 o'clock news. That's not going to happen. But indirectly, we're now talking nuclear weapons. Multiple people have now gone on camera to say they're regarding tactical nuclear weapons. This is probably, I think, a nuclear inspection by ET, in my opinion. At the time of world crisis, I think that base, which was the probably the top strike base in the country, should there be a Soviet invasion, that, in a sense, was something that ET found was there that shouldn't have been there. I mean, the weapon, the beam going down into the weapon storage area described a grid-like search pattern of the hot rod. Now, that shows intelligence. Why are they doing that? It's almost like they're scanning the weapons. Holt told me personally that beams had been shone down into the nuclear weapon storage area. I have that on video. He told me it on many occasions verbally. This is a huge swathe of material yet to come out, and when it does, it will probably fundamentally change the way we look at the Rendlesham case as it has been portrayed for the last 30 years anyway.
Wow. Well, I'll be definitely interested in that. And when do you expect that to happen?
We're hoping summer. We've done additional filming because other people came forward unexpectedly. So we've done additional interviews. It's in post-production. We're probably looking at summer 2020. But to put this in perspective, by then it will be nearly 3 years. I think James Fox's phenomenon has maybe taken 6 years, I heard. So, yes, it's not an easy thing. Yeah. And I think in the end, what should be the real criteria is if it's important, it takes as long as it takes.
And where will people be able to actually see this?
We're hoping to have it released theatrically in the UK in selected cinemas. Where it goes from there, we don't know. We don't know. That's not my area of expertise, but shall I say that production companies and distribution companies are interested in pursuing this, and we intend to take this to film festivals because it's all been done in 4K, both in the ground and on the air. It's got a proper soundtrack, multiple composers. Everything is designed for the cinema, sound, the view of it, and we'll show Rendlesham like it's never been shown before. So who knows what it will be received, but if there's any justice, given the amount of new information that will come out in it, it should do well.
Wow. Wow, that's great. Now, what has gone on in that area since that time? I've heard there's still things going on.
Well, I can attest to the fact that during the last 2.5 years of filming to date, we have had some experiences in terms of the film crew, the Capel Green film crew. We've also been alerted through general inquiries that will be revealed in the film to some sightings that have happened. Nothing to do with Capel Green, but then people have approached us. There are some remarkable things still going on in the forest. And I would honestly say, if somebody said, is there a presence of some kind in the forest, then I would have to say probably yes, which is a big thing to say, given my background. But I can attest to seeing batteries failing that have been, you know, camera batteries that were fully charged up. You go into a certain area and then they suddenly drain, phones draining, things like that. So I would say there is some kind of effect still there. But all will be revealed in the film.
Well, not all revealed. We won't see any aliens, right?
You might do. Special effects. You know.
Yeah, right. You know, that the battery... batteries draining and all that.
Typically,
I've heard that a number of times. Now, I just wonder, though, I always wonder this, and, you know, just to get your insight on it, why do you suppose there are certain areas that things happen in? You know, okay, we can say this had to do with the nuclear weapons, of course, but a lot of things have happened prior to nuclear weapons even existing, and then still ongoing, those weapons are long gone. Why do you suppose there's hot spots like this?
I don't think anybody really knows, certainly not in the public domain, whether the secret world of intelligence has uncovered things. Who knows? I have absolutely no doubt that special access programs have been studying this unofficially, shall we say, for many decades, and they know a lot more than us. I would hazard a guess that we only know 10% if we're lucky in the public domain. So 90% of it lies in the secret world of intelligence agencies and governments. What they know, who knows? But we all kind of, well, those of us who actively seek disclosure, hope that one day all will be revealed. And I think that will be a quite amazing day, just what is known.
Right. So let's just shift gears a little bit here. And what about when... you started this organization for police officers to report UFOs. How did that all come about? And let's talk about some of those cases.
After leaving the Air Force, I immediately, in 89, I immediately joined the British Transport Police. Everybody has to start in uniform. I did about 2.5 to 3 years in uniform, and then I always wanted to become a detective, and I then very quickly became a detective, and I was a detective for the last 19 years of my service. I was Home Office trained. I then did specializations in interviewing. That was my particular bag. It was something that I was always fascinated by. I liked being at the sharp end. I liked interviewing suspects in particular, and I also enjoyed taking statements. The interaction with people is good, but what I came to specialise in was deemed at an advanced level suitable for murder, manslaughter, rape. That's what was called the Tier 3 qualification. in UK policing terms. I did some training, but politics comes into this because I was a detective constable, not a detective sergeant. Our forced area would not allow a detective constable to become the tier four supervisor. It was political, so it had to be a detective sergeant, even though he was less qualified than me in interviewing. But that's just the way things go. But in terms of advanced interviewing, I went as far as you can go. Tier four was an area trainer, and tier five was a national advisor. So those people didn't get involved in the day-to-day interviews. I wanted to be at sharp end. Initially, when I joined the police, I did think I would want to go up the chain, as it were, go up through the ranks. But I quickly found that I liked interviewing, and I think this is probably the same of US police forces as well, that as soon as you got beyond the rank of sergeant, or even the rank of sergeant, you were effectively tied to a desk and you very rarely got out. And I was one of those people that liked to be out and about. And so I made a conscious decision just to stay as a detective constable, which would allow me to keep interviewing. So as I say, for the last 19 years of my service, I was an advanced interviewer, or I was an interviewer, and then as time went on, I became an advanced interviewer for suspects and witnesses. So I had 24 years, but during my service, a few things that had happened, and cutting a long story short, because I know time is of the essence, and we've digressed a bit on Rendlesham, is that having had my childhood sighting, I'd always had the interest. I'd got magazines where possible, books, read up on things. And then a strange kind of thing happened. I had a very vivid dream, and I don't usually remember my dreams, but I had a very vivid dream, and I've talked to Grant Cameron about this. I had a very vivid dream of a hypothetical Hollywood film script, a story, a scenario of what could cause disclosure, as in UFO disclosure. And I'd never written a thing in my life, and basically within 6 weeks I'd written a film script in a very shabby fashion because I didn't know anything about formats and everything. But I'd never written anything, so to go from a premise and then develop a middle and get to an end was quite a revelation. So it kind of told me that I could write. I then decided I want people to read it, so I took it to a copy of it, printed it off, took it to my colleagues, and one by one my colleagues in the police station where I was based read it, and they all came back and said, "Oh, this is brilliant, make a great film, or make a great book." And I said, "Well, I can't write a book, there's just too many words in a book. A screenplay is a fifth of that, and I much prefer the dynamic of film, because I'd always been a film buff." But eventually I plucked up the courage to send a copy of the script to somebody who is very highly regarded in the UK, Graham Birdsall, who was the editor of the printed magazine UFO Magazine. He was very famous in the 80s and 90s, in particular in the 90s, and he put on big three-day conferences in Leeds for many years, 21 years, and then sadly he died at the age of 49 suddenly. But in the last 2 years of his life, I'd approached him and said I'd had this idea. First of all, I sent him the script. He rang me up about 6 weeks after receiving it, and he said it was brilliant. I'll help you in any way I can. He then said, "Well, why don't you come to one of my conferences as a guest?" I'd never been to a UFO conference in my life. He invited me to Leeds to his big three-day conference, where there were people like John Mack there. And so I saw these, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And the spin-off from that was, subconsciously, I began to get frustrated at the way the mainstream media were portraying the subject. It was still very much dealt with a nod and a wink and a bit of ridicule. And yet I was always aware, right from my earliest days at 16, reading Kehoe's books about pilots chasing UFOs. And I'm always thinking, well, hang on a minute, this is a very credible guy. How can it be that this is just trivialized? But obviously, as my knowledge grew and I found out about the Robertson panel that was there to debunk from 53 onwards anything to do with the media, then it became obvious that the media were, whether directly or indirectly, complicit in helping to do the government's dirty work in kind of debunking the subject. So as a serving police officer, I began to think, how can I get involved? What can I do to change anything? And basically, cutting a long story short, I had a second dream that said create a database for police officers. And that was very vivid. Not like a film script, but the idea was there. So I went to Graham Birtle with it and said, look, I've had this idea for a police database, unofficial, but I'm still a serving detective, and so it should attract a lot of attention. Will you allow me to write an article in UFO Magazine, which was a printed magazine, went all around the world, a very big publications spin. And he said yes, because he realized I was a very credible person because of my policing background. I was a serving detective. This was a bit unusual. So he said, yeah, okay. So basically in January 2002, I launched with that first article in the January issue of UFO Magazine, the database publicly. And it wasn't a cascade of a flood of reports, but I began to get retired officers writing to me, emailing me, ringing me, because I'd given my contact details out, and they started to tell me about experiences they'd had. And I was already aware of some historical cases that had been reported in books and in magazines. So coupled with those, I then started to do the newspaper archive trawls and things, and found more. And so it's a combination. So when I went public, I attracted national media initially, and did quite a lot of interviews, TV, radio, that kind of thing. And it literally took off from there. I began with six cases involving about 10 to 12 police officers. Now the latest figures, and I don't do much research now because I do the UFO Truth magazine. That takes a lot of my time and Capel Green and writing. But the current figure is approximately 1,100 cases involving over 550 cases involving over 1,100 British police officers. So that's a hell of a lot in the 17 years, 18, 19 years since it launched. One of the things that I never anticipated was that UFO groups in the UK began to ask me to do lectures, something I'd never done, didn't know that I could lecture, but found that actually standing in front of 50 people, 100 people, 200 people, it made no difference to me. I found myself actually very comfortable in front of an audience. Most of my colleagues would run a mile to go in front of a TV camera or anything like that, but I guess it just came natural to me, and that was the spin-off. So I started to do lectures all around the country. And then from 2010 onwards, I then began to do international lectures all around the world. In 2010, Steve Bassett gave me the PRG, effectively World Disclosure Award, which was totally unexpected, which obviously added to my credibility. And I think now up to 18 countries I've lectured around the world, and I always pinch myself that people are prepared to pay for my flights and hotels just for me to speak for an hour and a half. I find it very bizarre, very humbling, because for a little guy from Scunthorpe, my hometown, I've gone on a very strange, convoluted journey, and it's still continuing, and where it will take me, I don't know. But I mean, 2013, I gave testimony at the citizens' hearings, which to me was an absolute privilege, and I gave testimony on behalf of police officers worldwide. That was bizarre, but you know, to talk at the National Press Club, two blocks short of the White House, it was an amazing thing. So I'm still on a journey. But the database still gets reports, not as many as it used to, because I don't actually seek it in the same way that I did. I was very active between 2002 when it launched and up to about 2013 when I launched the magazine. So between that time, the bulk of the sightings came in, both historical, newspaper, and personal officers contacting me. And there are some incredible stories that I've been told, which you probably want to talk about some of those now.
Yes, I do. But I just wanted to ask you this question. Where do these police officers come from? Is it just the UK or is it worldwide?
No, the Proof Force Police database is primarily for serving and retired UK police officers.
I see. Okay.
Although I have been contacted by many US, South African police over the time. From time to time, I'll get overseas reports. Australian, but I keep it to the UK because that's the country I know, and I can attest to some of the police procedures, whereas I wouldn't know particularly American police procedures, Australian police procedures. But the basic idea that a serving police officer could be replicated anywhere around the world. So you could have the equivalent in the, of a Proforce Police Database, police reporting UFOs in any country. All it would take is a serving or retired officer to do so. And I, what absolutely helped right from the off was the fact that, one, I was serving, and two, I could talk to them in a language that they understood. Because there were certain things that you could say off air, as it were, that were immediately realised that you were talking to another police officer. We just had that common bond, I guess, like a fireman to a fireman, a pilot to a pilot, that kind of thing. And so as time went on and I got quite a lot of media coverage, then people realised, and even officially, I was the single point of contact for several county police forces, district police forces. So if they had a sighting, they would say, well, do you want to talk to this guy? Because he collects reports. And they would also send me their police reports as well. So it was something that I'm extremely proud of. I had no idea that it would take me on this weird and wonderful journey. But it's something I'm very proud of.
Excellent. We're going to be taking calls in about 10 minutes. So I want the listener out there to know that if you have a call. I'll put that number up in about 10 minutes and I'll announce it then. But yeah, let's hear some of the cases that you think are really fascinating.
Well, there is so many, but there are always some that are kind of like just take your breath away. Here's one where two police officers who were protecting a British cabinet minister, so someone high up in the government, he was en route to another appointment, and it was cross country, so they decided that they were going to stay overnight in this like country mansion. So they were doing the protection of this cabinet minister, who will be named at some point in a book that I write about police officers. And basically he was in the hotel, overnight stop. It's 5 a.m, it's summer, the sun's come up, it's one of those beautiful blue sky, not a cloud in the sky. And he's in, the cabinet minister's in bed asleep, and it's 5 a.m, and they're walking in the grounds of the perimeter of the house. They're just walking around the grounds of the house, literally just following the outline of the building. And then suddenly the sky goes dark, and they look up, and there is a huge cylindrical purple-coloured UFO, approximately 100 metres long above the house where the cabinet minister is. Wow. One of them drew his weapon, and his mate said to him, I don't think that'll be much use now because of the size of this thing. It was completely silent. It blocked out the sky. That's what caused them to look up. They looked up in absolute awe and astonishment, and then in the blink of an eye, shot off towards the horizon, stopped briefly, gone. A great story corroborated by two effectively doing close protection work to a cabinet minister. Now, that's an interesting case in itself. Another case where three police officers in the middle of the night have met up in a rural area, and then suddenly, way off in the distance, they see a flash on the horizon. Just for a split second, they look. It's there only a second. They can't determine what it is, and it's gone. 5 minutes later, in a rural location and less than 500 metres from where they were, suddenly an object appears. It doesn't arrive, it just blinks on in the click of an eye and appears in front of them. Mm. It's at an altitude of about 500 feet. It's the size of, 10 times the size of a football-sized pitch. Big football-size object with six or seven smaller objects silently flying around the perimeter of the craft. Wow. It's shining a beam down across the terrain, like scanning the terrain, silently lighting up as it day. And they watch this thing for several minutes. And then suddenly, Blink of an eye, no noise, gone. Doesn't go up, down, left or right. It just turns out like a light bulb.
Wow.
An amazing sighting. Another sighting, and this is always made me laugh, and it's one I quoted at the citizens' hearings because I wanted to make this reference point to size. Two police officers, uniformed police officers, were packed up early morning, and then suddenly they become aware that there's a huge dark object blocking out the sky. They look, and just above treetop level, they see one of these famous black triangles, no noise, but they describe it as the size of three football fields. Now, I immediately came back to the officer and said, the size of three football fields? How can you say that? He says, because when we saw it, it was above three football fields. And that's a great confirmation of size, police officer-wise. That's a great way to determine that. You throw it back to them. How can you confirm? How can you tell it was at that time? Oh, well, I looked at my watch. That kind of thing. And it was a great confirmation of size. So a silent black triangle in a semi-rural area, the size of three football pitches, that just hovered there silently and then shot off in the blink of an eye and gone. These are the kind of things that police officers see. Another one, one that's never gone public because the officer doesn't want it going public until probably he dies, so that might be a while. But basically, I've got him on video camera telling me about this story where he's travelling over what is called the Pennines, which is a high set of hills, not mountains, hills, and he's travelling over the hills in a very rural area, and just as he's going over the tops, he sees through broken cloud a huge triangular object. But this is literally flying above their car. He stops to pull over. His wife's in the car with him. He gets out and he looks up and there is an object and he can see its undercarriage structure. And there are rows of like rails inside. He's looking up inside the triangle, all in total silence. And then it slowly, not fast, it just slowly drifts away off over the hills into the distance. There's no... Wow. With police officers, they rarely put their head above the parapet for fear of ridicule, a fear that it's going to risk their career. So when these people come forward, you can pretty much know within a minute of talking to them how sincere they are. And like I've spoken to someone, they're saying, I'm embarrassed to tell you. And I said, look, I've heard many, many things. Just tell me. Nothing will surprise me now. And you might spend the first 30 minutes just getting them to feel comfortable to relate the story. And then these amazing stories come out. You know, there are so many cases like that of flying triangles, so many cases of huge cylindrical object, some that are filmed. I've got one clip on film where two police officers, a man and wife, who were on shift together, uniform, they came off shift and at the end of their garden, they saw a huge cylindrical object that they described about 200 to 400 feet long, silent, with like a row of windows, just silently hovering there. And they filmed it on their mobile phone briefly. And then it was stood in an upright position. No method of propulsion. It was just rotating on its own axis. And in the video clip, which I put out at lectures, you could see it rotating in the sun. And as the sun turned, as it turns, you can see the sun reflecting off the metallic structure. And there is nothing to keep that object there. And they say they watched it for several minutes and then it just shot off at speed. There are many, many characteristics to what you see that are so common. Instant acceleration, instant stop, vertical acceleration, straight up, straight down, right angle turns, reversals. It's visible 1 second, then it's invisible. And generally, no noise, although sometimes a low hum is heard. Sometimes there's a louder noise, but generally 90% total silence. And we're often talking huge objects. So these are the kind of sightings that people have, and they're not uncommon. And they've been reported literally for decades. And the flying triangles have been around for a long time, not just from the 70s onwards. There have been flying triangle cases for a long time.
That's right. That's right. Wow, this is those are fascinating cases, really amazing. We're ready to start to open the phone lines here in about 3 minutes, but I wanted to, we may or may not get calls, you never know, week to week. But You said there's about, I believe you said something like 550 cases and 1,100. Did I say it? 1,100 officers.
Yes, that's right.
So does that mean that what we're talking about here is there's at least two police officers, or, you know, on a lot of these cases, or are there a lot of, or are there a number of situations where there was a lot of police officers actually seeing this one particular sighting?
What you have as a percentage, I'm not a big lover of statistics, because having worked in the police, you can twist statistics any way you want. But some statistics have been done. And generally, two-thirds of all of the on-duty sightings, i.e. when they're physically working or on duty, two-thirds are multiple officer corroborated sightings, so two or more. And there are literally dozens of four, five, six officer cases. One case is 22 plus. Another one is about 17 plus. And what you find is if one car sees it in a certain area, then they go over the air, and then another car says, I'm 3 miles away, I can see this too. And you get this kind of triangulation effect where multiple officers see different things from different perspectives. And in the biggest case that I've got, it's 22 officers plus, and that was called the Cosford incident, which has been highly reported from 1993. And it's one of the rare cases where Nick Pope did some work on it and concluded that there was some object in the UK airspace. But it's a fascinating case, and the object there travelled over several regional, we call them counties, in our area, which are many millions per county, and literally on that sighting it lasted several, about 200 miles, the course of the journey.
Wow.
Not too dissimilar to, if you think of the Phoenix Lights, had been tracked way before it got to Phoenix and was seen and videotaped. Lots of people were saying that they'd been watching it and following it leading up to the Phoenix sighting. So very similar to that. So there are two types of sighting. There are on-duty sightings, i.e. the police officers working. And two, I have a category for off-duty sightings, because for me, I don't really see a distinction. If a police officer is off duty and he sees something, well, he's still using the same thought processes. He's still using the same training that he's being given on what to look, and he's aware of how to write it up, in a sense, for court. You write, if you talk to a police officer, you don't write your own statement because you don't know how to write it for court. Police officers talk to you, then they write up your statement and read it back to you, and then say, well, certainly in the UK, they say, are you happy with that? If you're happy with that, sign it, kind of thing. Well, that's because the public do not know how the court system works. So you tell the story to a police officer, he writes it up, and then you play it, you read it back, and they sign it as an accurate record. Well, so in a sense, a police officer is trained in a methodical way, chronologically, to put things in order and think of how we would write it up if this was a genuine criminal incident and he had to write it up in his police notebook. And so that's basically where British police officers come from. Police officers, when I've talked to them, they will not go forward unless, or rarely go forward publicly, unless there is corroboration. But from time to time, people have done that, and they're to be applauded, because we need people to stand up and, in a sense, go public with these amazing counters. And they do so at some cost. A very famous British case is that of Police Constable Alan Godfrey, who is widely recognised in the UK as being the first British, well-accepted media-wise, abduction case. There have been cases earlier, but he was the one that, in a sense, went public, went around the world. It was all over the British TV. He was interviewed for many years. You know, he's been interviewed by film crews all over the world. And that was November 1980, just a month before Wren Lawson. And he basically had an amazing experience of seeing what he thought initially was a bus skidded across the road that turned out to be a diamond-shaped object, that was blocking the road in a rural country town at five in you know from between 5 and 6 in the morning. And basically, he said, I was that close to it, I could have thrown a brick at it and it would have gone bang. And it's just hovering off the ground. And he initially goes for his main radio, it dies. He goes for his car radio, it dies. He has a sketch plan, he draws it. And then a strange thing happens, there's a jump in time. And he's further up the road, like a missing time sequence. He spins the can around, where's the thing gone? Finds a circular patch of drier area in the road where the object had been hovering. It had been raining, it was drier. He went back, picked up a colleague, corroborated. I investigated his story. It's an amazing story. That story went all around the world. It's a really well-known British case.
Wow, that's great. We have a caller on the line. So the lines are open, and that number is 855-472-5483. If you want to write that down one more time, 855-472-5483. That is a show number only. And we have Andy on the air from Connecticut. Is this the Andy that saved the show last week?
Yes, sir, one and the same.
Thank you. Well done. Yeah, if it wasn't for you, Andy, there would have been no show. So I do thank you very much for last week.
That's right. Thanks for humoring me. Hey, my question is for Gary. As a police officer, I'm curious to know what he thinks about the situation with witnesses all over the world are always seeing, you know, cylindrical objects, cigar-shaped objects, orbs, things of that nature, as you'd expect, anything related to the UFO, characteristics. They're not seeing a pink tricycle floating upside down while the theme to Benny Hill plays. They're not seeing a clown talking backwards, you know, in a field of rainbow colored grass. They're always seeing the same things. So as a detective and as an investigator, what are your thoughts on the fact that are the objects people see worldwide, are they some unexplained condition or state of the human condition where people tend to see the same silly thing? Or obviously I think it's really happening, but isn't it odd that we're always only seeing UFOs? We're not seeing those other bizarre things I mentioned or anything like that. What are your thoughts on that?
When I went public in 2002, I was obviously had launched a database for primarily police officers. But because I was on the media, I used to get a lot of members of the public calling me because, hey, I'm this police officer, I'll tell this guy. And so I had to begin to get used to members of the public talking to me. And what I can tell you is that in my experience of the last 18 years, I know within a minute or so if someone is genuine or not. And what tends to happen is that whoever it is, within a minute, you can tell they are replaying the incident in their head. And there's a certain way that the tone of their voice, you can tell that they're just sincere. And this is common, I think, all around the world. And unfortunately, post the Robertson panel in 1953, anybody born after 1953 has lived in a world of debunking. And it's been a very successful policy. It's worked fantastically well. And unfortunately, the United States has controlled the subject and have been largely responsible for that playing down of the subject. Britain follows America's lead always, ever since. But I've met world-renowned researchers all over the world. And we all talk about the same thing. They all talk about the same kind of sightings. And you're right. They see cylindrical objects. They see saucers. They see triangles. And these are very credible people. But depending on where you are in the world is how the subject is viewed. For example, the first time I went to Brazil, I think in 2012, the conferences were absolutely packed to the rafters with hundreds outside, would love to get in, and there was just no tickets. The attitude in the South American countries is entirely different from the US, from Britain and Europe. There it's not ridiculed. And countries like Mexico, Chile, Peru, they are all pretty much openly accepting that these things are real, as in an extraterrestrial presence. And, for example, at that first conference, there was a general from the Brazilian Air Force present at a UFO conference. There was a colonel from the Uruguayan, I think, military there in the uniform. Now, that would not happen in the US. That would not happen in Europe. That would not happen in the UK. And so it's about attitudes. But again, let me give you another example about how real this subject is. My friend and colleague, AJ Javard, from Brazil, who runs his own printed magazine in Brazil, I've been there several times since. He has been doing long-term research of the kind of like people that live along the Amazon. These are pretty much third world villages set along the banks of the Amazon, pretty much don't have any real contact with the outside world. And he will, every year, take a boat and do a week's journey down parts of it, and because it's so big, it's been doing this many years, and he collects these stories from the local inhabitants, and their world might be only 2 miles one way down the river and 2 miles down the other. Their entire lives are down to that, and he has come to learn that they are seeing remarkable objects just the same as anyone else, and yet they don't have access to TV, radio, newspapers, film, etc. So that, in a sense, is the purest form of corroboration that it's a worldwide phenomena and the same objects are seen worldwide. So it's very real. I agree with broadly the 3% of all cases after investigation, RET. 95% of everything is generally can be explained, anomalous, is misinterpretation, atmospheric, that kind of thing, just plain mistake. 5% residue. Of the 5%, when investigators delve into those, you maybe lose another 2%. But you're always left of a hardcore of 3% that defy explanation after investigation. And that's the key thing, after investigation. And many of those cases, we're well aware of those. You know, there are, in that category, many of them relate to pilot cases and military pilots. 2,000 military pilots, 3,000 commercial pilots gone on the record over the years. You know, hundreds of radar operators, sonar operators, air traffic controllers. It's a huge body of evidence if we lived in a different climate. And I think it is changing, and it has changed significantly, or is beginning to change, as a result of what Leslie Keane put out on December 16th, 2017, about the Tic Tac incident. And obviously we've now learnt a lot more about the Nimitz incident and subsequent other incidents in 2014, 2015. You know, I've talked to some of those people who were involved. It's an amazing case.
All right. Well, hey, Andy, we have another caller, so thank you so much for the call, and thanks again for last week. All right. All right, so we have another caller, and that is Josh. Josh is calling from Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Josh. Listen, Josh, quickly, we only have a couple minutes here, so go ahead.
You're still on with Gary, right?
Yes, you are. Yes, you're on with Gary. He's with us right now. We're all set to go, so just go ahead.
So first, real quick, I'm going to say I love the show. I listen to you as often as I can.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I had a sighting about a year ago. It was about the shape of a tuna can, and it had a barbershop pole type of light running around the rim. And I had never heard anybody talk about this kind of sighting or this kind of object until you had the MUFON SAR team member on your show.
Hmm.
I wish I could remember his name. He you asked him what got him into UFOs, and he described an incident when he was 13 where him and his entire neighborhood in the middle of the day saw the exact same object. And I just wanted to share this with you because if not for you and your interview, this connection would have never have been made. So I thank you for that, Martin.
Sure. Yeah, that's a bizarre one. I like the bizarre ones because they're, for some reason, they seem almost more credible. Because,
you're right there. Yeah. That is a good point. When people are almost embarrassed to tell you, that's actually a good reassurance that something really happened. Because something happened that's really strange. So no, that was a very interesting case. And by the way, I have heard of a couple of kind of barbershop strips before.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, Gary, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much
just give you a special offer to your listeners?
Yes, you go right ahead.
If anybody emails me, heseltinegary@hotmail.com, you can put it out on your place. They can have a free copy of UFO Truth magazine. That's the magazine I do that goes worldwide. It's an online e-zine. So if they email me instead of listening to your show, they can get a free copy.
How about that? And that's a 96-page publication that comes out bimonthly.
Correct.
Yes. Excellent. Well, Gary, thanks so much. And thanks for hanging in. And, you know, we got into some interesting discussions for sure.
I know. I appreciate it. And it was a good discussion. And I guess you will not have this kind of discussion, certainly about Rendlesham, too often on the United States.
That's right. All right. You take care.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. All right, everyone. Anytime. So that's it for the show this evening. Next week, we have Chris Rutkowski on, and we'll be back with him. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show and everyone that is listening. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.